Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show all about the outdoors and public lands in the American West. My name is Aaron Weiss, coming to you this week from the home office at 8,000 feet, looking out at a beautiful winter's day in the Rocky Mountains. We have a fabulous interview on the way with hunter, TV host, and public lands activist Randy Newberg. Whether you are a sportsman or not, I promise you will appreciate his take on conservation, politics, and the future of public lands in 2017. And this week in Western history, we will remember a legendary voice born this week in 1943. But first, we are going to start with some breaking news. As we tape this introduction, President Obama just finished declaring two new national monuments, Gold Butte in Nevada and Bears Ears in Utah. I suspect I don't have to say this for most of the listeners of this podcast, but I will anyway. This is a big effing deal. Gold Butte covers 300,000 acres of red sandstone canyons and mountains in the Mojave Desert. The indigenous rock art there is known around the world. It's also the home of the threatened Mojave Desert tortoise. Gold Butte is also a capstone to Senator Harry Reid's conservation legacy. He, along with Congresswoman Dina Titus and Paiute tribal leaders, were instrumental in convincing President Obama to issue the monument proclamation. And yes, it is also where Clive and Bundy illegally let his cattle roam feral. But it's important to remember two things. First off, all grazing in Gold Butte was already banned. It has been since 1998. And secondly, even if Bundy's cattle hadn't been causing all that ecological damage, the cultural and historical significance of Gold Butte alone is worthy of a monument declaration. As for Bears Ears, the monument there covers just over 1.3 million acres. That is less than what the Intertribal Coalition had asked for, but very similar to a proposed conservation area that was in Congressman Rob Bishop's Public Lands Initiative bill that he drafted but failed to pass earlier this year. Bishop is, of course, beside himself today that President Obama would dare to finish what the congressman couldn't. He is at yet another press conference as we speak, lamenting his own ineffectiveness, but that is par for the course at this point. If you want to read more about Bears Ears, check out a piece I wrote a couple of months ago on the history of efforts to protect the area. It goes back literally 80 years to a proposed Escalante National Monument that was presented to FDR as a proposal back in 1936. We took that original map, and you can see how over the years, most of the area did get protection as national parks, conservation areas, and monuments. The one hole left on that 1936 map is basically the area that President Obama just protected. So with these latest monument declarations, President Obama has protected more than 5.5 million acres of land and over 550 million acres of water offshore as well. We don't know if more monument declarations are still on the way. There is a very active push to protect the Greater Grand Canyon from uranium mining and efforts to expand monuments in Oregon and California. But even if these declarations are his last, President Obama has clearly cemented his legacy as one of America's great conservation presidents. Now, on to this week's interview. Randy Newberg is a hunter and the host of Fresh Tracks on the Sportsman's Channel. It is a show solely about hunting on America's public lands. And as you can tell in this interview, Randy is very passionate about those lands and wildlife and why conservation is so important to him and to future generations. We taped this conversation before these latest monument designations, so we're not going to get Randy's take on Bears Ears and Gold Butte. But I should note that the declarations President Obama issued specifically allow hunting and fishing, firewood gathering, and other traditional uses. So this interview is a reminder that national monuments do not lock up land by any means. They guarantee that land will be available to all Americans for decades to come. And with that, here's Randy Newberg. I want to start off with your story. How and when did you become a hunter?
You know, it's hard for me to tell the story of me becoming a hunter without connecting that to the importance that public lands held in that evolution. And I grew up in northern Minnesota in a little town of 500 people where everybody used these public lands to acquire food. For us, it was about what we would fish, what we'd catch while fishing, berry picking, foraging for morels, and hunting. And when I was about 11, I think it was, yeah, my parents got divorced. And it was right at that time where in Minnesota, at age 12, you can become a hunter. And it was, like many situations, it wasn't necessarily a pretty thing. And so here I was growing up in this culture of hunters and anglers and self-reliant people. And one of my dreams in life was to become a hunter and do the things all my uncles and grandparents and everyone had done. And unfortunately, my life circumstances had changed at that point. But even this 11, 12-year-old kid that I was able to walk out my back door and jump onto the public lands that were less than a mile away and hunt and do all the things that I wanted to do. So if it were not for public lands, Randy Newberg would not be a hunter. Randy Newberg would not be a public land advocate. And as I've told this story many times before, that is a uniquely American story, that somebody gets to go and participate in these things on public lands in a manner that very few other places in the world can you do it. And having a mother who was trying to raise three kids as a waitress, me being the oldest, if I would have asked her, "Mom, I need $1 a day to go hunting," she wouldn't have been able to do it. And it would have broke her heart to see my dream shattered of wanting to hunt, but that was just a financial reality. And having public lands right out my back door allowed me to go and do that. And so that's kind of how I became a hunter, growing up in a family, in a community, in a culture that hunting was just part of how we acquired food. I really didn't know any different. I some would say I didn't have much choice.
So it sounds like your identity as a hunter and your identity as an activist really are entwined. Was there a point at which you realized that, hey, the activism for public lands is a core part of who I am?
Yeah, there was, Aaron. And it wasn't until years later. I just took for granted, like many of us probably do, that every place and everyone has accessible lands, whether it's, in my case, to hunt, to fish, to hike, to camp, whatever. And then I moved west, and in some of the states where I lived, public lands were not necessarily as accessible as one might think. They always were abundant, but I also came to realize how much private land there is and that it required trespass fees or it required special permissions or no access at all. And I would say probably, well, my son was born in 1990, and it was 2 or 3 years after that I really understood. I started to realize, you know what, Randy, you were blessed to grow up in a place with public lands. You are blessed now to live in a place, Bozeman, Montana, with so much public land. Are you going to become an activist? Are you going to become an advocate for those who will come after you, the same as others were activists and advocates before me? And it just became part of who I am. I will say that becoming a father definitely changed my perspective on that, or maybe not changed my perspective, but lit the fire under me that this is important. This is part of what makes America great. And I'm going to do what I can to conserve it, to improve it, and to make sure it's there for those who come after me.
You end up doing a lot of trade shows, public events, things like that around your show. What do you say to hunters from the Midwest or the East Coast who haven't hunted on public lands before? Is there a light bulb moment for them?
There is a couple what I'll call light bulb moments. One is when they realize that 70% of hunting in the West happens on public lands. Because where they come from, like all of us, we're a little bit creatures of our own local environment. So if they mostly hunt on their uncle's farm or they have leases or whatever, they don't quite grasp what hunting is and how it works in the West. But I ask them, you know, imagine if 70% of your hunting access went away. And they're like, ooh, that would not be good. And so the other thing is, many of the Midwest and Eastern states, their state land boards are underneath their Department of Natural Resources, which is kind of the parent organization for a lot of things. So they don't quite grasp how different the Western state land boards are from what they're accustomed to. So the easiest example for me to provide them is Colorado. And I tell them, now, the state land boards of these Western states are not the same type of entity that is managing these lands, say the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management. These land boards have a constitutional or statutory requirement that they manage these lands for a specific set of beneficiaries, not the general public, a specific beneficiary group. And when I say Colorado is the easy example, Colorado, if you go to their land board, they've recently taken this statement off their website, but it used to say, caution, Colorado state trust lands are not available for public recreation. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, if you support this idea that we should transfer the Forest Service and BLM lands to the state land boards, you are transferring it to an entity in Colorado, as this example, where the 23 million acres of Forest Service and BLM lands that you might come and hunt as a non-resident elk hunter or a non-resident deer hunter, those would no longer be available to you. And they, at first, I almost get the look of disbelief, like, you're making this up.
How could this be true?
And then I explain it. It opens the door to allow me to explain it to them further. And that is that light bulb moment of, oh my goodness, that's a dumb idea.
So, I mean, you're very involved, obviously, in this fight against the land seizure movement, the folks who had handed over to the states. And we've all seen the arguments that they claim nothing changes, but everything gets better. And, you know, as you've explained, legally, that cannot be the case because it's enshrined in all of these Western state constitutions. So what's your read on the state of the land seizure movement right now? Where do things stand today?
Well, the state of the land transfer movement at this time feels quite energized. They feel that this is their once-in-a-generation opportunity, that maybe they can accomplish what has been stated all along. And even though they want to sterilize it by calling it things like state transfer, they want to call it better management, they want to call it all these things, let's go back to where it really started. It started as sell the public lands. And anyone who doubts that, I think it was last January, what, 11 months ago, the Mountain States Legal Foundation just came out and said, you know, let's cut through the fog here. Let's call this what it is. We need Congress to sell the public lands, dispose of the public lands. So it gets painted as all these other things, but really the end goal is to get rid of the public lands. And so those people right now, they feel energized. They think that the election in November was some mandate of support for their cause. And what they've been doing in the prior, I'd say, 2 to 5 years has been taking it at the state legislature levels. And to me, this just looks like that was all a marketing plan of let's go out to the masses and let's create the narrative that the federal government can't do this, can't do that, that this is a problem, that's a problem. And then once we've proven or tried to make that case out on the landscape, let's congressionally transfer these lands to the states and use the states as the mechanism by which they'll be disposed. Because if we look at the examples of how these state land boards have sold their lands, Nevada being the most striking, Nevada has sold over 95% of the state lands that they inherited at statehood. That's a lot of land. Oregon has sold 55% of the state lands they inherited, and right now they're still in the process of selling another 90-some thousand acre forest. And so these people, the Rob Bishops, the others who are leading that movement, believe that their time has come, and they fully intend to try make the most of that.
So you think it sounds like that there's some fundamental dishonesty when the American Lands Council, Ken Ivory, claims that, no, this isn't about selling off. You think that that's just them not being honest with the American people about the ultimate outcome, regardless of what they say.
I absolutely disagree with their premise that this is not about land sales. You can say what you want, but the facts in history lay a pretty clear pattern that the Sagebrush Rebels, I happened to be going to college in Nevada in the late 80s when the last Sagebrush Rebellion kind of struck up, and it was all about sell the public lands. Well, they got their teeth handed to them in the mainstream American sentiment. The Americans are like, we're not selling these public lands. So they kind of crawled in a hole for 10 or 15 years trying to craft a better marketing pitch. So they came back with the marketing pitch of, let's transfer the public lands. Well, but if you look at the history of the Western states, Utah, they have land auctions all the time. They just auctioned off a big chunk of land in southern Utah, and they promoted it. They will tell us, oh, these are not prime recreation lands. These are the isolated parcels. These are the blah, blah, blah. Well, if you look at the auction that Utah had in October, their sales flyer said, prime big game hunting, control access to adjacent BLM land, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Don't. It's insulting to any of us who follow and watch this that they promote it as that and try to convince the people that this is really some effort about better management, about care for the land, care for public access. It's none of the above. And if you want to roll back the layer a little further, just look at where the funding comes from for these groups. Look at the groups who make up their leadership. Look at the people who are leading them and speaking on their behalf. Every one of them are carrying the brand of sell the public lands, dispose of the public lands. And they can deny it all they want, but history and facts show otherwise.
I suppose we should note that Utah sale you mentioned, some of those parcels were inside the proposed Bears Ears National Monument. I mean, so clearly prime, both recreational and archaeological and hunting land that everyone seems to agree right now is deserving of protection. And that is literally what Utah was just selling off there.
Yeah. It's so obvious to anybody who can look at it objectively, exactly what you said. These were not lands that were out in some isolated, landlocked, parched part of Utah. These were prime, perfect lands that all of us as public land advocates for recreation, for the heritage sites, for everything else, they were brought forth for auction against the tone of what they say they're going to do. They say, oh, we're only going to sell the isolated parcels. They're going to have no values for this or that. And what do? They sell the prime stuff. And as someone who watches this from another state, the fact that Utah decides that they don't want to manage their lands properly, that they want to liquidate them rather than manage them for a return to their landlord. You know what, Utah? I'm not inclined to give you more inventory of federal lands just because you've decided you want to sell your state lands. When you run out of inventory, that's for you and your citizens to worry about. As a United States citizen, there's no way I'm going to support giving these states more lands to liquidate.
All right, I want to change gears here. One of the things I love to do on the podcast is talk to folks about their experiences on lands in the West. Now, obviously, as part of your show, Fresh Tracks, you have traveled all across the West. First off, how do you pick your locations for where you're going to go hunt and film these episodes?
Yeah, I am very lucky, Aaron, that I get to travel the West, and our show is all public land hunting. And when we pick a place, we want it to have a story about the conservation of the species that we're going to be hunting, and we want it to have a landscape story. And so by design, a lot of the places we go to have a very compelling public land story. Just so many remarkable places. And unfortunately, TV only gives you a half hour to tell all of the story. But on our website and elsewhere, we try to expand on how the people are connected to this landscape story. And there's so many of them. The depth of public lands and what it adds and how it is woven through the culture of the West is so remarkable. It's a story that I hope, if one thing comes of this movement of trying to take these lands from the American citizens, I hope one of the things that comes of that is we realize the rich history, how these public lands have built who we are as a country, as a society, as our cultures. And without them, we are going to lose a huge part of America.
Give us a little peek behind the scenes. What goes into producing, I mean, just a half hour of television, it must be a tremendous amount of work to get down to just those 30 or 22 minutes.
Yeah, it is a lot of work. You know, most people think we just walk around out there with the cameras rolling and everybody has a good time. But before we go there, we have to apply for the hunting permits, because each state is highly regulated about where you can hunt and what species you can hunt and all that. And then we have to apply for our public land filming permits with either the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service. And then we sit down, and before we get there, we create a production book that starts down the path of what will this story be? And what's the landscape story? What's the species story? And then we have these other parts of the episode that don't read a script, and it's called The Animals and the Weatherman. And so
they
we
don't
show
cooperate.
Up there and we start building. No. Very often the wildlife and the weather and the animals we're pursuing have a completely different idea of what the storyline should be. So we have to be quite adaptive. And usually we start out the first day with a story, what we think it will be. And we give ourselves 5 days on each of these episodes to go and film. By about day three, the storyline has usually changed 90 degrees, 120 degrees, sometimes 180 degrees. And so it requires a lot of adaptation on our part. And then when we're all done, we look at it and say, all right, where is a piece of the story here that we can interject these public lands, a current issue, a relevant topic, the wildlife issue? And then we come back with probably on each hunt, we come back with 15 to 25 hours of footage that we have to cut down to 30 minutes for TV. So no small project.
Have you ever had a shoot go completely sideways on you?
Oh, yeah. We usually do 10 to 12 a year because we have to deliver to the network 10 episodes. And very often, there will be one or two each year that just go completely sideways. We just got done with one in southeast Idaho. We went down there archery mule deer hunting, and it's 2 to 3 inches of crunchy snow everywhere. And me and a camera guy trying to get within 30 yards of a group of mule deer in crunchy snow, that just doesn't work. Needless to say, the deer won. So we probably won't get an episode out of that. We've also had instances where the weather was so bad that we hike a peak and we set up a spike camp and we sit there for 4 of our 5 days waiting for the snow to clear. It's zero visibility. We've had those instances, but all of that becomes a story in the bigger part of what adventure on public lands can be about. And so we may not get an episode out of a certain trip, but it plays into the bigger story of here's what public lands are, here's how we can enjoy them, here's how much opportunity exists. And we try to bring that to the viewer, even if it doesn't hit on TV. We try to bring it to them on our YouTube channel, or we bring it to them on our big forum. And I think it worked pretty well that we have our share of failures. That's part of being out on the public lands with animals that don't read the script and weather that does what it's going to do.
And it can be rewarding. just being out there is obviously just part of it. Is there anywhere you're dying to shoot that you haven't had the chance to film yet?
Oh yeah, that list is long. There's a part of me that wants to go to the coastal areas of Oregon and Washington. That's one place we've not got to. There's some places in Wyoming that, as much as we've filmed in Wyoming, there are still some places I need to get to. There are places in Nevada that are still high on the list of, I got to go tell this story. There's places even in my home state of Montana that we've not got to. There's a place called the Scapegoat Wilderness here in Montana on the Rocky Mountain Front. Remarkable piece of country that home to grizzly bears and deer and elk and just as wild gets in the lower 48. And the story of the Scapegoat Wilderness is a story about, at least for me, about a hunter from Lincoln, Montana. His name was Cecil Garland. They were going to make the Scapegoat a ski resort development area. And he said, over my proverbial dead body. And he rallied the locals back, I think this was in the 70s, to go to Congress and get the Scapegoat designated as a wilderness area. And it's stories like that that, to me, are so compelling and so invigorating. They just give me a fire of, you know what? Cecil Garland did this. I need to go and tell the same story somewhere else. There are stories like this on every public landscape. Who are the local heroes? Who are the people who made a difference for us today that we've probably never talked about? And so it's I could list a whole pile of places. I'm going to cross one of those off my list next month. I'm going to the Coronado National Forest in Arizona, and remarkable place. I'm going there. So my list will get shorter each year, but it seems like every time I go somewhere, I end up adding another one or two places to the list that I didn't know about.
So you got plenty of seasons still to come. I think that's a great chance to kind of take a step back and look at the history and the big picture here. It does seem like the broader conservation movement has come around in recent years to understand that sportsmen are very important allies in what they're trying to accomplish. How did that happen from your perspective?
I think you're exactly right, Aaron, and I'm thankful to see that intersection happening. You know, those of us in the hunting community, we've looked back at public lands as just part of our cause, part of what we stand for, and it goes all the way back to Theodore Roosevelt. We in the hunting world carry his DNA forward. He was not only president, but he was a very engaged hunter, and he stood up against some very big interests, some interests that it's almost like history's repeating itself. He stood up against interests that wanted to get rid of these public lands, and he fought them, and through creativity and perseverance, he created hundreds of millions of acres of additional public land. And so I think the hunting community has always carried that ethic forward that, you know, we've made a commitment to these public lands and we're going to do something about it. And we're not going to stand silent while others try to deteriorate or impair or otherwise hurt the value of these public lands. And so you bring that forward 100 years. And right now, if we just look at it from purely a pragmatic sense, the world, if we look at the current state of the political landscape, most would say hunters are slightly right of center. And right now, the Congress, the White House, the people in power are some far right, some, you know, slightly right of center. If there's any group that can hold the line and hold people accountable for public lands, for clean air, for clean water, the hunters and anglers, those of us who are maybe slightly right of center or in the middle, we have a very important role to play. And I think we can be some of the most effective advocates for the cause of public lands, of access, of clean air, clean water, all the things we as Americans love. And hopefully our ability to make progress on that causes others to say, hey, yeah, we have so much in common. Let's look at what we have in common, not where we have differences.
When you encounter a conservationist who might not understand your perspective as a hunter, how do you get them to see that, to understand that nexus, the alignment of interests? Is there something that you say when you talk to them that they suddenly get it of, oh my gosh, we are coming from the same place, even though I may not be a hunter or a fisherman or a sportsman?
Yeah, and you know, we're all a product of our perspectives on life are what our life experiences are. And I accept that not everybody's had a life experience of growing up in a small community where a large portion of their food comes from the local landscape. Not everybody has that life experience to have the perspective I do on it. So I try to think about it as, okay, this person came from a different background, but that doesn't mean they aren't passionate about public lands. It doesn't mean they aren't passionate about wildlife, wild places. So how can I craft my story, if you want to call it that, in a manner that they can appreciate and open-mindedly say, oh, I get that. And for me, it usually starts with the food side. You know, even today, what me and my family eat is so much obtained from the wild landscape. And I accept that others don't have that opportunity, that they have no choice but to participate in our commercial agricultural system. But when we start talking about some of the basics of what this land provides, food, recreation, opportunity to go and just explore, very quickly, the barriers that someone might have seem to get really low. And it's because I don't approach it in an offensive way or defensive way. I just say, here's my story. Myself, my community, a lot of people I associate with, we want to know where our food comes from. We want the responsibility of obtaining our own food. We like the quality of the food that we get. And oh, by the way, here are all the things that we do from an advocacy standpoint, from a standpoint of volunteering our time or our talent or our money to try make this better. And I don't expect everybody to say, oh, hey, thanks, Randy. Now I'm going to go pick up a shotgun and I'm going to go rabbit hunting tomorrow. I don't expect that result. But I hope that in the process, they understand that the hunting community has a serious investment personally, traditionally, historically, and in the future of what we want in healthy lands, clean air, clean water, and robust, abundant landscapes that can produce wild animals that, as hard as it is for some to understand, that is a food source for a lot of us. And when you break it down to those basic elements, it usually gets to be a very good discussion real quickly.
So I'll take someone like me. My wife and I, we take our daughter trout fishing in our, you know, stocked ponds that are nearby where we live in outside of Denver. I grew up shooting 22s at summer camp, but I'm not a hunter. How would you get me started? What's the first trip you'd recommend someone like me take?
Yeah. And so we'll just go to, okay, you've shot a 22 and you've got some basic familiarity. I would probably suggest that whatever it is that you want out of this experience, whether it's food, think about, all right, how can I participate in these public lands from a food standpoint? And it would probably start with becoming familiar with the game laws and the regulations, which every state is highly regulated. A lot of people are under the impression that as hunters, we can just go out and do whatever we want. Not the case at all. So you'd have to go and get your license and get the equipment. But I would tell people, ease into it, start into it. And even if it's not because you want to go and acquire food, go and try to interact with the landscape and these animals in a way to get closer to them, to understand them more, whether it's through bird watching, photography, or hunting. And go to wherever your comfort level takes you to start with. I've engaged with many people who are now hunters as part of the food movement. And they now completely understand the importance of hunting from a food standpoint. And I can't say that everybody's going to follow the same path, but I think those who approach it with an open mind and say, I want higher quality food, I want sustainable food, I want food that comes from the local landscape with a very low carbon footprint, if that's how you want to measure it, they're going to do the research and they're going to find all the studies that say, wow, obtaining protein through hunting from the local landscape is one of the lowest impacts from a measured carbon footprint that you can find as far as obtaining high quality protein. And then the quality of the protein, we read about it all. I mean, all of us read the articles about, you know, this type of problem with the food system and these things done to increase productivity and how that might increase the quantity of food but reduces the quality of food. Those kind of things help people mentally start down that path. And so if it was something you were going to do, I'd say, Aaron, find somebody who maybe's been down that path before, somebody you know, maybe someone who can mentor, for lack of a better term, show you a few of the steps along the way, but expect some unexpected. I still think about when I shoot a deer, it's still very hard for me to reconcile that this deer had to die so that I can live. That some animal is going to cross my plate, whether it's in the form of protein, whether it's in the form of agriculture that gives me my fruits and vegetables. Those are still hard reconciliations for me. And so I tell people, when you start hunting, it's one of those surprises of, okay, there's that rabbit or that grouse or that deer. It's a powerful moment when you realize that that is going to feed you. And so when you have that powerful moment, expect it, because it will be unexpected, both in terms of its power and in its gravity to how you look at this. It's a mental preparation, it's a emotional preparation, and it's also just the logistical and physical preparation of being able to go and do it. Hopefully that gives you a short starting point and a long answer.
Absolutely. All right, last question, because I've kept you over time here. Walk me through the perfect hunt for you. What does it look like? What does it feel like?
What does it look like? What does it feel like? Remarkably, at this point in my life, a lot of people would think, oh, the perfect hunt has to result in me filling a tag and bringing home an animal. And I would say that is so far from the case. There was a point in my life where that was important. You know, we view ourselves as providers for our family and such. But now the perfect hunt for me would go to a place I've probably never visited before. It would be facing challenges of the elements, the weather, sharing the public land. Because a lot of times when we're on public land, which we are all the time, many of those times we encounter other hunters. And guess what? Sometimes that messes up what you think is the greatest plan. So in this perfect situation or that I would recall and look back on fondly of the wonderful hunt, I'm probably going to have some of those challenges of other hunters, of the weather, of whatever it is. And I'm going to push myself beyond some part of my comfort zone, whether it's physically, mentally, or otherwise. And I may or may not have a success. It, as weird as that sounds, at this point in my life, I want to be able to look back and say, I experienced the fullness of hunting these public lands. And if I end up with meat in my freezer, that's great. If I don't, I still find it a very rewarding experience.
All right. Randy Newberg is a hunter, television host, public lands activist. You can catch his show Fresh Tracks on the Sportsman Channel. Also check out his podcast, Hunt Talk Radio. Randy Newberg, thank you for your time. Thank you for your activism, and thank you very much for your perspective today.
Thank you, Aaron, and thanks for all you guys are doing. That's a great help, and we're going to get through this. We're going to win, no doubt.
It's a plan. We always finish up the podcast with a look back at this week in Western history. 163 years ago, the United States bought just under 30,000 square miles of land from Mexico. The treaty was signed by James Gadsden, ambassador to Mexico, on December 30th, 1853. It was the final major acquisition of territory in the continental U.S., including the towns of Tucson, Sierra Vista, and Yuma, Arizona. The Gadsden Purchase cleared the way for a deep southern railroad line, which the Southern Pacific completed 30 years later. This week also marks the birthday of one of the most beloved musicians in American history, John Denver. He was born on New Year's Eve, 1943. Henry John Deutschendorf Jr. was his birth name, born in Roswell, New Mexico. His dad was an Air Force pilot, and the family moved often. He was a musician early in life. He sang in the Tucson Boys Chorus for 2 years, a fabulous arts organization, if I do say so myself. The name John Denver didn't come along until a gig with the New Christy Minstrels. Deutschendorf didn't fit on the marquee, so the director introduced him as John Denver, and that was that. It is hard to overstate the impact John Denver had on the entertainment world in the 1970s. His Christmas special on ABC in 1975 was watched by more than 60 million people. He was also politically active. He founded two environmental groups. He had a strong interest in finding solutions to world hunger. And, like his father, John Denver loved to fly. He had 2,700 flight hours in single and multi-engine planes, even in his Learjet. It was October of 1997 when John Denver purchased a kit plane in California. The plane had a valve to switch between the two fuel tanks, but the person who built it put it in a hard-to-reach spot behind the pilot's shoulder. So it was just his second flight on the plane when John Denver lost control. He was trying to switch those fuel tanks in flight. He crashed into Monterey Bay and was killed instantly. In his adopted home state of Colorado, flags were lowered to half-staff. His ashes were scattered in the Rocky Mountains. John Denver's music is now the official song of two states, Rocky Mountain High in Colorado and Take Me Home Country Roads in West Virginia. There is only one other composer to have two state songs, and that's the father of American music, Stephen Foster. Well, that is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. We will have much more on the Bears Ears and Gold Butte Monument declarations after the new year, as well as a look back at President Obama's conservation legacy. If you like what you hear, please leave us a rating on iTunes. That is the best way for other people to find what we are doing here. And of course, we love your feedback. Podcast@Western Priorities is where you can send your praise, questions, complaints, ideas for future episodes. My name is Aaron Weiss, and from all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, Happy New Year.